curiosity. What was at the top of the staircase? What did Chicago look like beyond this one platform? Carmine tilted his head up and leaned back in her arms, floppy as a sack of rice.
"Yite,"
he murmured, pointing. Following his gaze, she saw that just up ahead was the enormous ceiling of the train station, laced with skylights. They stepped into the huge terminal, filled with people. There were wealthy women in furs, trailed by servants. Men in top hats and morning coats. Shop girls in bright dresses. Dutchie was standing in the middle, looking up at the sky through the huge panes of glass, with a huge grin on his face. Suddenly, he took off his cap and flung it into the air. Carmine struggled in Neve's arms, and when she set him down, he raced toward Dutchie and grabbed his legs. Dutchie reached down and hoisted the baby onto his shoulders. He clasped Carmine's legs and began to twirl. Carmine stretched out his arms and threw back his head, shrieking with glee, and that flicker inside Neve sharpened and brightened into joy. Joy so sharp it felt like the edge of a knife. Even though it hurt, she hugged the feeling tightly. It was nothing she'd ever experienced before, and she didn't know if she'd ever feel it again. A whistle blasted through the air. Neve spun around, trying to see where the sound had come from. She spotted three policemen in dark uniforms racing toward Dutchie and Carmine. Mrs. Scatcherd had climbed the stairs from the platform. She raised her black wing, pointing toward the two boys. Mr. Curran pushed past her. Dutchie froze. Carmine grabbed his hair and shrieked. Just then, someone seized hold of Neve's arm, another policeman.
"Trying to get away, were you?"
he hissed in her ear, his breath smelling of licorice. Neve twisted in his grasp, trying to see what had happened to Dutchie. He was face down on the ground now, the policemen surrounding him. Carmine was on the ground as well, sitting beside Dutchie, crying and bewildered. Neve tried to go to him, but the policeman yanked her back. Then another policeman hauled Dutchie roughly to his feet, and they were both dragged over to Mrs. Scatcherd. A third policeman carried Carmine.
"These are your charges, ma'am?" one of the policemen asked.
Mrs. Scatcherd nodded.
"Unfortunately, they are."
She looked as if she'd bitten into a lime.
"I placed this young man with you," she said to Neve in a quietly terrible voice, "in the hope that you might prove a civilizing influence. It appears that I was gravely mistaken."
Neve wanted to tell her that Dutchie didn't mean any harm. That she didn't either. That both of them just wanted to see what was at the top of the stairwell. That they just wanted to spin and laugh under the bright sky. "No, ma'am, I..."
"Do not interrupt!"
Neve looked down.
"Now, what do you have to say for yourself?"
"I'm sorry." Neve knew that Mrs. Scatcherd was not going to approve of her. Never again. But maybe she could still save Dutchie. If Mrs. Scatcherd sent him off the train here, in Chicago, what would he do? He didn't have his bootblack kit. He couldn't make money for himself. "I asked Hans, to take me and the baby into the station," she told Mrs. Scatcherd. "I thought maybe we could get a glimpse of that lake. I thought the baby would like to see it." Mrs. Scatcherd glared at her. Dutchie looked startled but said nothing. Carmine said, "Yake?" Mrs. Scatcherd's face softened.
"You are a foolish and headstrong girl," she told Neve.
But her voice had lost its edge, and Neve could tell that she wasn't as angry as she wanted to appear.
"You disobeyed my instructions. You've disgraced yourself."
She turned to the officers in their uniforms.
"But this is not, I think, a matter for the police."
The officer holding Dutchie let him go. Molly, Spruce Harbor, Maine, present day. After Jack has packed up his backpack and gone home, Dina calls from the kitchen that dinner is ready.
"So, how's that community service working out?"
Ralph asks when Molly gets to the table. He pours himself a big glass of milk. "Fine," Molly says. She picks up a piece of corn on the cob from a platter in the center of the table and plucks a hot dog gingerly from the bun on her plate. She sets the meat, quietly, to one side.
There's lots of stuff in that attic. 20 hours worth?
Asks Dina.
I guess there's other things I can do if we finish the attic, Molly says. That house is huge.
Yeah, sure is. I know the house. I've done some plumbing work over there,
Ralph says.
Old pipes. Is Jack's mom usually there when you're working?
Molly nods. She's around, doing laundry and stuff. Dina gives her a funny smile.
Terry Gallant doing laundry. Now there's a picture.
Molly looks at her in confusion.
Come on, Dina,
Ralph says mildly. Dina ignores him. Back in high school, Terry Gallant was Miss Popular, homecoming queen and all that, she tells Molly. Now she's scrubbing floors, huh?
Molly turns her attention to her food. When she's done, she picks up her plate, with the hot dog still on it. She remembers to thank Dina for dinner.
Neve, Chicago, Illinois, 1929. By the time they left Chicago, it was evening. As the train chugged out of the station, Mrs. Scatcherd rapped Dutchie's knuckles several times with a long wooden ruler as punishment for leaving the platform. He barely winced, then shook his hands twice in the air and winked at Neve. Carmine sat on Neve's lap, face pressed against the window, gazing out at the streets and buildings, all lit up. Yite, he said softly, as Dutchie flopped onto the seat beside him.
Get a good night's rest, children, Mrs. Scatcherd called from the front of the car. In the morning, we'll be making our first stop. You will need to be at your very best if you want to be chosen by a kind family.
What if nobody wants me?
One boy asked. And the entire car seemed to hold its breath. Mrs. Scatcherd looked as if she'd been waiting for this.
If it happens that you are not chosen at the first stop, there will be several later chances. I cannot think of a time...
She paused.
It is very rare for a child to be with us on the return trip to New York.
Pardon me, ma'am, a girl near the front said. What if I don't want to go with the people who choose me?
What if they're mean?
A younger boy cried out.
Children!
Mrs. Scatcherd's glasses flashed as she turned her head from side to side.
I will not have you interrupting!
But was she going to answer the questions or not? Everybody had their eyes on her.
I will say this.
She looked sterner than ever.
Some parents are looking for a healthy boy to work on the farm. Some people want babies. Parents sometimes think they want one thing, but later change their minds. We dearly hope all of you will find the right home at the first stop, but it doesn't always work out that way. Be respectable, polite, and keep your faith in God. Whether your journey is long or short, he will help you, as long as you place your trust in him.
Neve looked at Dutchie. Mrs. Scatcherd hadn't really answered the question, but the message was clear. Mrs. Scatcherd did not know, any more than the children knew, whether they'd be treated with kindness. This train was taking them steadily into the unknown, and they had no choice but to sit quietly in their hard seats and let themselves be taken there. Chapter 6. Molly, Spruce Arbor, Maine. Present day. Molly is starting to figure out that cleaning out the attic actually means taking things out of boxes, looking at them for a few minutes, and putting them back where they were. After a week of going through Vivian's stuff, the pile of things to throw out or give away is tiny. A short stack of musty books, a few sheets and pillowcases, yellow with time. I don't think I'm helping you much, she tells Vivian one afternoon in the attic.
Well, maybe not, says Vivian. But I'm helping you, aren't I?
Molly twitches inside and clamps her mouth shut. Does that mean Vivian knows about the stolen book? That Molly has to do her hours to stay at Ralph and Dina's?
With your service project,
Vivian adds, looking at Molly a little strangely, as if she's wondering why Molly seems panicked. Molly sticks her head into a cedar chest and pulls out an old-fashioned brown dress with pearl buttons down the front. The kind of thing, Molly thinks, that you might see on an American Girl doll. Not that Molly ever had one, but she's seen the catalogs. Next to the dress is a crumpled turquoise cardigan, embroidered flowers fraying, green leaves springing loose from their stitches. Under the sweater, Molly uncovers a green hardcover book with the words Anne of Green Gables stamped on the front in gold.
"Hand me that," Vivian says.
She takes it and opens it to an illustration of a wide-eyed girl with her red hair in two braids.
"Ah, yes, I remember," she says.
"I was not much older than you when I read this for the first time.
A teacher gave it to me. You remember? Miss Larson. Upright and do right make all right."
Molly does remember that it was Miss Larson who'd made Vivian copy out that sentence. She can't imagine having a favorite teacher who'd assign a boring writing exercise like that, but Vivian is smiling. She leafs through the pages.
"Anne talks so much, doesn't she? I was much shyer than that," she looks up. "What about you?"
"Sorry, I haven't read it," Molly says. She wishes Vivian would stop talking about books. Is she hinting that she knows? Does she want Molly to confess? Well, if Vivian wants her to say something, she can just ask. Until then, Molly is keeping her mouth shut. She pulls more things out of the chest. Clothes, book, knickknacks wrapped in old newspaper, and sets them on the floor.
"No, no, I mean, were you shy as a girl?" "What am I saying? You still are a girl. But I mean, when you were younger."
"Not exactly shy. I was quiet. Still am," she thinks.
"Circumspect," Vivian says.
Molly looks at her a little suspiciously.
"What does that mean?" "Watchful," says Vivian. "Careful. Reserved."
That seems about right. Molly is surprised. How does this old lady know her so well? Teachers always complain that Molly is sullen, that she won't speak up in class, that she doesn't try to make friends. That's what Lori was getting at the last time they had lunch. Nobody seems to realize that she's watching and waiting, trying to decide if it's safe to speak up. Vivian closes the book.
"You strike me as a reader. Am I right?"
Molly shrugs. This feels like a trap. At any moment, Vivian is going to spring it on her.
"So, what's your favorite book?"
"I don't know. I don't have one."
"Oh, I think you probably do. You're the type."
Molly jerks upright. What's that supposed to mean? The type to steal a book? The type to lie about it to an old lady who needs help with her attic? But Vivian's face is not accusing, merely interested.
"I can tell that you feel things deeply."
She leans forward and, to Molly's surprise, presses the book into her hands.
"No doubt you'll find this old-fashioned. Sentimental, even. But I want you to have it."
"You're giving it to me?"
"Why not?"
Molly looks down at the book. She nearly got thrown out of her foster home for stealing a book. She's only here in this attic because she stole a book, and now Vivian just hands her one? As if it's that easy.
"Do I have to read it?"
she mutters.
"Absolutely. There will be a quiz," Vivian says, with a twinkle in her eye.
Despite herself, Molly smiles. "I'm terrible at quizzes."
"I doubt that very much," Vivian says. "Anyway, I hope you'll like it."
"Well, thank you." She holds the book to her chest before setting it beside her on the floor. Then she picks up an ancient pair of brown mittens that look like they've been gnawed on by a mouse. Maybe several mice. "I can get rid of these, right?" Vivian takes the bedraggled mittens from Molly's hand.
"I think maybe I'll hang on to them," she says.
Which is what she says just about every time Molly asks that question. Neve. Milwaukee Road Depot, Minneapolis, Minnesota, 1929. Neve slept badly on the train the night they reached Minnesota. At dawn, she was wide awake, so full of nervous energy she could feel the blood pumping through her heart. She untied the ribbon in her hair and let it fall to her shoulders. Then she combed through it with her fingernails and pulled it back, as tightly as she could. Turning, she caught Dutchie looking at her.
Your hair is pretty,
he said. She squinted at him to see if he was teasing. That's not what you said a few days ago.
I said redheads have a hard time getting chosen. Not that I don't like it,
he shrugged.
Can't help what you are, can you?
Neve craned her neck to see if Mrs. Scatcherd might have heard them talking. But there was no movement toward the front of the train car. Most of the other children were still asleep. Carmine snored a little, his head on Neve's lap, his little feet on Dutchie's leg. Dutchie wrapped a hand around Carmine's feet.
I never said thanks.
For what?
For what you did at the train station. You could have told them it was all my idea, going up to the waiting room. You were just following me.
I wouldn't have done that, Neve said, a little indignantly.
I know, but there's a lot who would.
Dutchie leaned forward a little.
Listen, wherever we go, let's try to find each other.
How can we? We'll probably end up in different places.
That's true.
And my name will be changed.
Mine too, maybe. But we can try.
Neve hesitated. Back at the orphanage, they said we should make a clean slate. Let go of the past.
I can let go of the past, no problem.
Dutchie picked up a wool blanket that had fallen to the floor and tucked it around the lump of Carmine's body.
But I don't want to forget everything.
Neve nodded. She felt that way, too. Outside the window, she could see three sets of tracks parallel to the one their train was on. And beyond them, broad, flat fields of furrowed soil. The sky was clear and blue. The train car smelled of diaper rags and sweat and sour milk. Mrs. Scatcherd stood.
All right, children, wake up!
She clapped her hands several times. Around her, Neve heard small grunts and sighs as the children who were lucky enough to have fallen asleep opened their eyes and stretched their cramped arms and legs.
Clean faces, combed hair, shirts tucked in, Mrs. Scatcherd said briskly. Big ones, please assist the little ones. Bright eyes and smiles. You will not fidget or touch your faces. And you will say what, Rebecca?
Please and thank you. A girl with blonde ringlets murmured sleepily.
Please and thank you what?
Please and thank you, ma'am.
You will wait to speak until you are spoken to. And then you will say, please and thank you, ma'am. You will wait to do what? Andrew.
Speak until you are spoken to,
a brown-haired boy guessed.
Exactly. The good citizens of Minneapolis are coming to the meeting hall today with the intention of taking one of you home, possibly more than one. So remember, girls, tie your hair ribbons neatly. Boys, button your shirts. Do everything in your power to make it easy for a new family to choose you. Is that clear?
The train pulled into the station with a high-pitched squealing of brakes and a great gust of steam. Carmine was quiet, gaping at the buildings and wires and people outside the window. Neve wanted to say something to Dutchie, but she could not think what. Her hands were clammy. It was a terrible kind of anticipation, not knowing what they were walking into. They lined up in the aisle, Neve with the solid weight of Carmine in her arms, Dutchie carrying their bags.
Quickly, children, Mrs. Scatcherd said. In two straight lines,
that's good. Her tone was gentler than usual.
This way.
They followed her off the train and up a wide stone staircase. Mr. Curran brought up the rear. At the top of the stairs, they made their way down a corridor lit by glowing gas lamps and into the main waiting room of the station. It was not as big or as beautiful as the one in Chicago, but it was bright, with large windows. People pointed and whispered. Neve wondered if they knew why the children were here. And then she spotted a printed paper attached to a column. In black block letters, it read,
Wanted. Homes for Orphan Children. A company of homeless children from the East will arrive at Milwaukee Road Depot Friday, October 18th. Distribution will take place at 10 a.m. These children are of various ages and both sexes, having been thrown friendless upon the world.
As if someone had turned a crank in her back, Neve shuffled forward, one foot after another. She smelled something sweet, candy apples, as she passed a vendor's cart. How strange, she thought, that she'd ended up in a place her parents and brothers and sister had never been, and never would be. How strange that she was here, and they were gone. She touched the Claddagh cross around her neck. Ahead, Mrs. Scatcherd stood beside a large oak door. When the children reached her, they gathered around in a semicircle, the older girls holding babies and the younger children holding hands. Neve's stomach felt hollow and trembly. Mrs. Scatcherd nodded.
All right, Mr. Curran, we are ready.
Mr. Curran leaned against the door with his shoulder, pushing it open. Chapter 7 Molly, Spruce Harbor, Maine, present day. For the past week in Molly's social studies class, they've been studying the Wabanaki Indians. For the first time since she started at Spruce Harbor Middle School, Molly's been sort of interested. Anyway, it's better than diagramming sentences in language arts, that's for sure. Molly already knew that Wabanaki means people of the Dawn Land, because they lived where the first light of day touches the American continent. But Mr. Reed's been telling them some stuff she didn't know, like the fact that the Wabanaki are actually a confederacy of 5 tribes, including the Penobscot, Molly's own tribe, that live near the North Atlantic coast. Last week, they went on a field trip to the Abbey, a museum about Native American culture in Bar Harbor. Molly lingered by the Penobscot baskets, made out of sweet grass and bark from birch trees and brown ash. This week, Mr. Reed is telling them about their final project. It'll be worth a third of their grade.
Portaging, Mr. Reed says. Everybody remember what portaging is?
Molly remembers learning about portaging at the Abbey Museum, but she doesn't raise her hand. Mr. Reed focuses on her anyway.
Molly?
Molly sighs, but speaks up. Well, in the old days, the Wabanaki had to carry their canoes and everything they owned across land, from one body of water to the next. When they came to the end of one lake or river or whatever, they had to pack up and bring it all on their backs. Mr. Reed nods.
Thank you, Molly. So, if you know you're going to have to portage, you think carefully about what to pack, right? You need to travel light. You take what's essential, what you can't live without, and you leave the rest behind.
Molly touches her necklace.
For this project, I want you to interview someone in your family. Someone older. Your mother, a father, a grandparent. Someone who's lived through things you haven't. And ask them about a time they had to take a journey of some kind. Maybe it was an actual journey, maybe just a change of life, trying something new. Ask what they took with them from their old life and what they decided to leave behind. You'll turn the answers they give you into a report for the class.
Mr. Reed starts the kids off brainstorming questions they can ask during their interviews.
You can ask if they brought photo albums,
Megan McDonald calls out, 2 seats in front of Molly. Other kids add suggestions. Mr. Reed scribbles them all on the board.
Get out your notebooks and write these down, he tells everybody.
Molly pulls out a notebook and begins to write, but she doesn't raise her hand to add anything. She's too busy wondering who she's going to talk to. If her father were still alive, she'd pick him. Maybe she'd write about how he named his only daughter after Molly Molasses, a Penobscot Indian born the year before America declared its independence. She'd lived into her 90s, like Vivian, Molly thinks, coming and going from Indian Island, where Molly herself was born. The Penobscots said Molly Molasses had powers, Mateulin, given by the Great Spirit. People with those powers, her dad told her, could interpret what dreams meant, cure diseases, and tell hunters where to find game. It's too bad Molly didn't wind up with any of those powers herself. Maybe if she had, she wouldn't have been moved around so much from one place to another. Maybe she would have been born to a mom capable of remembering that a kid needs to be fed now and then. Maybe she could even have protected her dad from that car accident. But she didn't, and her dad's not here, so she can't write about any of that. She could interview Ralph or Dina, but she cringes at the thought. It would be like she's trying to get them to be her mom and dad or something. Ugh. So how is Molly going to make this project work? Neve. Milwaukee Road Depot, Minneapolis, Minnesota. 1929. Neve stood at the back of the large, windowless, wood-paneled room, with Carmine in her arms and Dutchy right behind her. The room was filled with rows of people sitting in chairs, murmuring and looking back at the children. Mrs. Scatcherd motioned to the children to follow her down the center aisle. As she led them toward a low stage at the front, the crowd quieted, row by row. Surely, Neve hoped, someone here would want her. Maybe she'd go to live in a bright, sunny house, where there would be warm cake to eat and tea with as much sugar as she wanted. But she was quaking as she made her way up the stairs to the stage, hugging Carmine tight. They lined up by height, smallest to tallest. Though Dutchy was 3 years older than Neve, she was tall for her age, and they were only separated by one boy in the line. Mr. Curran cleared his throat and began to make a speech. He asked the crowd to remember that they would be doing a good deed, saving a child from poverty and sin and depravity. He talked about the paperwork. He said that the families watching could have a child for free, but they would have to feed and clothe that child and send him or her to school. At first, it would be a 90-day trial. If they didn't like their choice after 90 days, they could send the child back. The girl beside Neve made a low noise like a dog's whine and slipped her hand into Neve's. The adults lined up and began to climb the stairs to the stage. Neve felt like one of the cows for sale at the market in her village in Ireland. In front of her, now, stood a young blonde woman, slight and pale. An earnest young man was beside her, wearing a felt hat. The woman stepped forward.
"May I?"
"Excuse me," Neve said. The woman held out her arms. She wanted Carmine. He took one look and buried his face in Neve's neck. "He's shy," Neve jiggled him, trying to get him to look up.
"Hello, little boy," the woman said. "What's your name?"
Carmine peeked up at her and nestled his warm, sticky cheek against Neve's neck.
"The crossed eyes can be fixed, don't you think?" the woman said to her husband.
"I don't know, I would reckon so," he answered.
The woman stroked Carmine's arm with her finger.
"Sweet thing," she murmured.
He picked his head up and gave her a bashful smile. She looked at her husband.
"I think he's the one."
"Nice lady," Neve whispered to Carmine, swallowing a lump in her throat.
"She wants to be your mom."
"Mom?" he said, his warm breath on her face.
"His name is Carmine,"
Neve told the people. Reaching up, she pried the little boy's monkey arms from around her neck. The woman put her hand on Carmine's back, and he squirmed away from her and clung to Neve even more tightly.
"No, no, no," he insisted.
"Do you need a girl to help with him?" Neve blurted out.
"I could," she thought wildly, trying to remember what she was good at. "I know about babies. I took care of my little sister, and I can mend clothes and cook."
The woman's face filled with pity.
"Oh, child," she said. "I am sorry. We can't afford to. We came here for a baby. I'm sure you'll find..."
Her voice trailed off. Neve pushed back tears. Carmine started to whimper.
"You must go to your new mom," she told him firmly, and peeled him off her neck.
She would not cry, she told herself fiercely. She would stay polite and neat, and she would smile and say please and thank you. The woman took Carmine awkwardly. Neve guessed that she was not used to holding a baby. She reached out and tucked the little boy's legs under his new mother's arm.
"Thank you for taking care of him," the woman said.
Before Neve could answer, Mrs. Scatcherd swooped over and herded the young couple and Carmine off the stage. Neve felt as if a piece of her heart had left with him. One by one, the children around Neve were chosen. The boy between Dutchy and Neve went off with a short, round woman who told him it was high time she had a man around the house. The girl who'd held Neve's hand went off with a stylish couple in hats. Dutchy and Neve were standing, talking quietly, when a man came closer. His skin was as tan and scuffed as old shoe leather. A sour-looking woman trailed behind him. The man eyed them for a minute without a word. Then he reached out and squeezed Dutchy's arm.
What are you doing?
Dutchie asked, startled.
Open your mouth.
Neve could see Dutchie's hand closing into a fist, but Mr. Curran had come up behind them, so Dutchie didn't dare throw a punch. The man stuck a dirty-looking finger into Dutchie's mouth. Dutchie jerked his head away.
Ever work as a hay baler?
The man asked. Dutchie stared straight ahead.
You hear me, son?
No.
No? You didn't hear me?
Dutchie looked at him.
Never worked as a hay baler. I don't even know what that is.
What do you think?
The man asked the woman.
He's a tough one, but we could use a kid this size.
I reckon he'll fall into line, she said.
We break horses. Boys aren't that different.
It was just as Dutchie predicted, Neve thought. Country people looking for free labor. They walked off with Mr. Curran without a glance at Dutchie.
Maybe it won't be that bad, she whispered.
If he lays a hand on me.
Dutchie glared at the farmers retreating back.
They have to send you to school,
he laughed.
And what'll happen to them if they don't? Who's even going to check?
You'll make them send you, Neve insisted.
Hey, boy! Stop your dallying!
The man called, clapping his hands so loudly that everyone turned to look. Dutchie reached into his pocket and slipped a penny into Neve's hand, the one he'd used for his magic trick to make Carmine laugh.
For luck.
You need it, too.
I know my fate, don't I? Looks like you're the one getting back on that train.
Then he walked across the stage and down the steps, waving at Neve with a sad smile as he joined the couple who'd chosen him. Neve was alone again. Chapter 8 Molly, Spruce Harbor, Maine, present day. Once she gets home from school, Molly takes the vacuum cleaner out of the closet in the hallway and runs it over the carpet in her room, careful to get into every corner. She pulls the quilt loose from her bed and tucks it in again, making sure the corners are sharp. There are a few pieces of crumpled up paper and a Skittles wrapper in the little trash can by her desk, so she picks it up and carries it to the kitchen. Dina is home from work early and she's putting away dishes from the dishwasher. She snorts softly as Molly nudges past her to empty her trash into the big bin under the sink.
Why don't you clean up the living room if you've got so much energy, she says, dumping silverware into a drawer.
Molly doesn't answer, retreating to her room as quickly as she can. She flops down on the perfectly made bed, staring up at the ceiling. Straightening up usually makes her feel better, but today it doesn't. Molly knows perfectly well why her mood is as sour as month-old milk. It's that portaging project. It never seems to occur to teachers that not everybody has a big family at home, a mother, a father, grandparents, all eager to help out. Mr. Reed's pretty nice, and if Molly tells him she doesn't have anyone to interview, he'll probably let her do something different. But Molly is sick of explaining to people why she's not the same as everybody else. She pulls her phone out of her pocket and calls Jack.
What's up?
He asks.
Do you have to do some kind of portaging project for social studies? She asks.
Some kind of what?
Portaging project. Portaging is...
Never mind. The thing is, I've got to interview somebody. Somebody old. Mr. Reed said maybe our grandparents, but obviously... She figures Jack will understand. His family isn't exactly like a Norman Rockwell painting either. His dad was a migrant worker, picking blueberries when he met Jack's mom. Before Jack was even born, the guy made his way back to the Dominican Republic. Terry stayed in Spruce Harbor and raised Jack on her own.
Yeah,
Jack says.
I get it. I remember when we had to do a family tree in fourth grade, I couldn't fill out any of the stuff from my dad's side. It turned in half a tree.
Molly laughs a little.
But this project will be easy.
Molly frowns.
What do you mean?
See? You should listen to me more. Didn't I already tell you to ask Vivian questions?
Vivian?
Molly sits up with surprise.
Why not?
Well, it's supposed to be a family member.
Just check with your teacher, Jack says. I'm sure it'll be okay.
He's probably right that Mr. Reed would agree to it.
and Vivian is certainly the oldest person Molly's ever met. For some reason, though, she feels like she has to argue with Jack. But it's not like Vivian had a big dramatic life or anything, she says. She was adopted and grew up in Minnesota. Her parents had a department store. She ran it. Then she retired and moved to Maine. Her life sounds pretty boring.
Who cares if it's boring, Jack says. You just need a passing grade.
Maybe she won't talk to me.
Maybe you should just ask, huh?
Jack's right. Molly knows he's right. Okay, I'll ask, she mumbles. I bet she'll say no, though.
Portage?
Vivian looks quizzical.
That sounds like, I don't know, a pie made of sausage.
Molly wrinkles her nose.
Carrying my canoe between bodies of water? I've never been one for boating.
Vivian shakes her head.
What's it supposed to mean, exactly?
The idea of portaging seemed clear when Mr. Reed was explaining it. But now Molly's not so sure herself. Maybe I could just ask some of the questions on my list, she suggests.
Well, I suppose you can try.
They are sitting in the red wingback chairs in the living room, their work in the attic finished for the day. Vivian calls for Terry, saying that she needs a cup of tea and that Molly does, too. After a few minutes, Terry brings them the tea in thick white mugs. Vivian stirs sugar into hers and pushes the bowl over to Molly. Molly has never really liked tea that much, but she stirs in the sugar and tries a sip. Not bad. It warms her from the inside out. She pushes down the button on the tiny digital recorder that she signed out from the library at school, takes a deep breath, and asks Vivian her first question. So, have you ever gone on a big trip in your life? I mean, moved from one place to another? Vivian, who was raising the mug of tea toward her lips, seems to change her mind. She sets it down on a small table by her chair.
Yes, she says. Certainly.
Molly waits a few seconds, but Vivian doesn't say any more. From where to where? Molly asks. Vivian looks at the recorder in Molly's hand a little warily, as if it might hiss or bite.
Well, when I was young, my family moved from Galway, that's in Ireland, to New York City. But I took an even bigger journey a few years later.
From where to where? Molly prompts again.
From New York to Minnesota. On a train.
Neve, Albans, Minnesota, 1929. As the train pulled up to the depot, Neve could see that the town of Albans was barely a town at all. There was no station, just a platform open to the wind and sun. The children who hadn't been chosen in Minneapolis were herded in a line toward the Grange Hall, a block from the station. This time there was no stage, so Neve and the other children walked to the front of a large, bare room and turned to face the crowd. What would happen if no one wanted her here either? She'd go on to the other stops. Maybe back to New York and the orphanage. That might not be so bad. She knew what to expect there. Hard mattresses, rough sheets, strict matrons. But also other girls to live with, three meals a day, school. It was probably better than what Dutchie was facing. A woman came closer, her eyes on Neve. She had wavy brown hair cropped close to her head, a plain white blouse, and a dark, paisley scarf. There was a large oval locket on a gold chain around her neck. Seeing it, Neve reached up and touched her own necklace. The man standing behind the woman was stout and red-faced, with shaggy auburn hair, the buttons of his waistcoat strained across his stomach.
"What's your name?"
the woman asked. "Neve," she said, her voice almost lost in the noise of footsteps, coughs and sneezes, mutters and whispering.
"Eve?"
"No, Neve. It's Irish," she says.
"The name would have to change,"
the woman said to her husband.
"Whatever you want, my dear."
She cocked her head at Neve. "How old are you?"
9, Mum.
"Can you sew?"
Neve nodded.
"Do you know how to cross-stitch, hem? Can you do back-stitching by hand?"
"Yes, Mum,"
Neve said.
She used to help her mother when she took in extra work darning and mending. The woman nodded at the man, who put his hand on her back and guided her to the side of the room. Neve watched as they talked. He shook his head. He gestured toward Neve. He stooped and bent close to whisper in her ear. She looked Neve up and down. Then the two came back over. "I am Mrs. Byrne," the woman said. "We employ several women, making clothes to order. We are looking for a girl who is good with a needle." Neve didn't know what to say. She was good at sewing better than other girls her age. At least, that's what her mom had said. But she didn't know if she wanted to announce this. She didn't know if she wanted to go with this grim woman. If she didn't, though, somebody worse might come along.
"I will be honest with you. We do not have any children, and we have no interest in becoming parents," the woman said stiffly. "But if you are respectful and hardworking, you will be treated fairly."
Neve nodded to show she understood.
"Good,"
Mrs. Byrne said. She shook Neve's hand, as if they'd just made a business deal. Somehow Neve realized she had already agreed to go with these people. Once the paperwork was done, Neve followed the Byrnes out to their car, a black Model A. Mr. Byrne opened the rear door for her. The leather seats were cool and slippery. The two adults took their places in the front and didn't look back. With a loud rumble, the car sprang to life. Neve could see that the Byrnes were talking in the front seat, but she couldn't hear a word over the noise of the engine. Several minutes later, Mr. Byrne pulled into the driveway of a small beige house. As soon as she turned off the car, Mrs. Byrne looked back at Neve and said, "We've decided on Dorothy." It took a moment for Neve to realize what she meant.
"You like that name?"
Mr. Byrne asked.
"For goodness sake, Raymond, it doesn't matter what she thinks," Mrs. Byrne snapped as she opened her car door. "Dorothy is our choice, and Dorothy, she will be."
Molly, Spruce Harbor, Maine, present day. One of the things Molly likes most about Spruce Harbor is the Island Explorer bus. It's free, and it makes one big loop around Mount Desert Island. Molly can get on the bus after she's finished at Vivian's, get off about 15 minutes later, and then it's just a short walk down the main street of Spruce Harbor to Ralph and Dina's. This time, on her way back, Molly stops to look in the window of the thrift shop. A t-shirt catches her eye. Tie-dyed, with colorful turtles splashed across the front. Their shells, deep blues and rich greens, remind Molly of little planets spinning in space. But it's not black. When is the last time Molly bought a piece of clothing that wasn't black? She stands there, looking, and in the glass of the window she sees a reflection from across the street. It's Megan, from social studies, walking with two other girls Molly doesn't know. They're all laughing at some joke. Megan's bright hair, gold with a touch of red, swings out as she clutches one of her friend's arms and points across the street. "Let's check out the thrift store," she says, loud enough for Molly to hear. Molly stuffs her hands into her pockets and starts walking fast, away from Megan and her friends, before they can see her standing there alone. Neve, Albans, Minnesota, 1929. Neve, who couldn't imagine how she was going to think of herself as Dorothy, followed the Byrnes inside the house, into a small front hallway, gloomy and dark. Shadows from the white crocheted curtains on every window cast lacy shapes on the floor. To the left, through an open doorway, Neve could see red-flocked wallpaper, a shiny wooden table and chairs, a dining room. Then Mrs. Byrne opened the door to the right onto a room that, to Neve's surprise, was full of people. Two women in white blouses sat in front of black sewing machines with the word Singer spelled out in gold, each pumping one foot on the pedal underneath. Neve stared, fascinated, as the needles on the machines moved up and down. She'd heard of sewing machines, but never seen one up close. A young woman with frizzy brown hair knelt on the floor in front of a cloth mannequin, stitching tiny pearls on a bodice. A gray-haired woman perched on a brown chair, hemming a calico skirt. And a girl who seemed to be only a few years older than Neve,
sat at a table, cutting a pattern out of thin paper. Mrs. Byrne looked around the room. As you know, we've needed extra help for quite some time, and I am pleased to report that we have found it. This is Dorothy. She lifted her hand in Neve's direction. Dorothy, say hello to Bernice, the woman with the frizzy hair. Joan and Sally, the women at the sewing machines. Fanny, the gray-haired woman, the only one who smiled. And Mary. This was the young girl with the scissors, who barely glanced up, only returned to her work with an angry face. Mary, you will help Dorothy get familiar with her tasks. She can take over some of yours. Fanny, you will oversee. As always.
Yes, ma'am,
Fanny said. Well then, Mrs. Byrne said, let's get back to work. And she left. Neve spent the next few hours doing jobs no one else wanted to do. Basting garments together with quick, large stitches so that one of the older women could finish them with finer work later. Sweeping. Collecting pins and putting them in pin cushions. After a while, she was forced to speak up. Excuse me, I need the lavatory, she said to Mary. Can you tell me where it is? Mary looked annoyed, but before she could answer, Fanny got to her feet.
Reckon I'll take her.
Neve followed her into a spare and spotless kitchen and out the back door to an outhouse.
I'll wait,
Fanny said.
You don't have to,
Neve told her.
The longer you're in there, the longer my fingers can have a rest.
The shed was drafty. Strips of newspaper hung on a roll on the wall. Neve had used a privy back home in Ireland, so the smell didn't shock her. But she couldn't help wondering what it would be like out here in a snowstorm. When she was finished, she opened the door, pulling down her dress.
You're pitiful thin, Fanny said. I'll bet you're hungry.
She was right. Neve's stomach felt hollow.
A little,
she admitted.
Mrs. Byrne don't give us much for meals, but it's probably more than you had.
Fanny reached into a side pocket of her dress, neatly made of cotton printed with purple flowers. She pulled out a small, shiny apple.
I always save something for later. She locks up the refrigerator between meals.
She handed over the apple.
I don't want to.
Neve hesitated.
Go ahead. You got to learn to take what people are willing to give.
The apple smelled so fresh that Neve's mouth watered. She reached out a hand for it, and Fanny nodded.
You best eat it here before we go back in,
she advised. In a few bites, Neve devoured the apple down to the core. Juice ran down her chin, and she wiped it with her hand, and then licked the sticky sweetness off her skin.
Why doesn't Mary like me?
She asked, her mouth still tingling with the taste of the apple.
Pish! It isn't that she doesn't like you, child. She's scared.
Neve blinked, astonished.
Of me?
She thinks you're going to take her job,
Fanny said.
Mrs. Byrne holds her money tight in her fist. Why would she pay Mary to do the work you can be trained to do for nothing?
Now it was clear. Neve was little more than slave labor.
I'm the only one who isn't paid.
Fanny's smile was kind.
You can see why Mary would be threatened. And she knows you're good with the needle. Come now, or we'll be missed.
That night at supper, Mrs. Byrne served chopped beef, potato salad stained pink by beets, and rubbery cabbage. Neve was so hungry by then that it felt as if something was clawing at her stomach from the inside, but she forced herself to put her napkin in her lap and take small bites. No one spoke until Mrs. Byrne put down her fork and said, Dorothy, it's time to discuss the rules of the house. You'll use the privy in the back once a week. On Sunday evenings, I will draw a bath for you in the washroom off the kitchen. Bedtime is at 9 p.m. with lights out. There's a pallet for you in the hall closet. You'll bring it out in the evening and roll it up neatly in the morning before the girls arrive at 8:30. Neve was startled into speech.
I'm sleeping in the hallway?
Mercy! You don't expect to sleep on the second floor with us, Mrs. Byrne said with a laugh. Heaven forbid. After dinner, Mr. Byrne went for a stroll. Mrs. Byrne said that she had work to do upstairs. Neve was left with the dishes. By the time she finished scrubbing and drying and had wiped down the counter, the clock above the stove said 7:30.
She poured herself a glass of water from the tap and sat down at the table. It felt too early to go to bed, but she didn't know what else to do. She wished she had a book to read. At home, in New York, there weren't many books in the house. But the twins were always bringing home day-old newspapers, and they'd puzzle out the stories. Or she might recite a poem she'd learned in school. She closed her eyes and whispered, "All that we see or seem is but a dream within a dream." But that was all she could remember. "It's not so bad here," she told herself. The Burns weren't particularly kind, maybe, but they didn't seem cruel. They didn't want to be her family, but perhaps that was for the best. Carmine might be happy with his new mam, but he was just a baby, ready to love anyone with gentle arms and a smile. Neve was no infant. With the Burns, she'd have food, a place to sleep, work to do. Perhaps that was enough. And soon, she would go to school. She'd have a better life than poor Dutchie, she thought. She found her suitcase in the hall closet, along with a pile of bedding. She unrolled a horsehair pallet and put a thin yellow pillow at the top. There was a white sheet and a moth-eaten quilt. When her bed was settled, she visited the privy outside. On her way back in, she noticed that someone, Mrs. Byrne, it must have been, had come into the kitchen while she was gone. There was now a padlock on the refrigerator door. Chapter 9. Molly, Spruce Harbor, Maine, present day. It's Monday, but there's no school. It's a teacher enrichment day. Ralph and Dina are at work. Jack's playing soccer with some friends, and Molly doesn't feel like spending the entire day alone at home. She figures she might as well head over to Vivian's and get some of her hours done. She's been going there on her own for a couple of weeks already. She'll catch the bus back and be home again before Ralph or Dina get off work. She'll bring the tape recorder, too. It's still in her backpack. Maybe she can ask Vivian a few more questions. At Vivian's, Molly rings the bell, but nobody answers. Cupping her hands against the glass, she peers into the dim hallway. Vivian never goes out, does she? Molly tries the doorknob. It turns. "Hello?" she says as she steps inside. Maybe Vivian can't hear her. Molly walks down the hall and hesitantly looks into the living room. The shades are closed. Vivian isn't there. Should Molly leave? Without any voices to listen to, the old house is full of noises. Floors creaking, window panes rattling, flies buzzing, curtains flapping. She can smell old books and something savory from the kitchen. Terry must be in there, cooking. Molly is looking at the books on a bookshelf when a door opens. She glimpses the kitchen on the other side, and Terry bustles in. Molly turns. Hi. Terry shrieks, clutching the rag she's holding to her chest. What are you doing here? I rang the bell a few times, Molly stammers. I just kind of let myself in. I thought,
does Vivian know you're coming this early?
Not really. There's no school, and I... Terry narrows her eyes and frowns.
There's no school. That doesn't mean you can just show up here whenever you feel like it.
Molly can feel her face getting warm.
I know. I'm sorry. Vivian has a routine. Gets up at 8 or 9, comes downstairs at 10, but that's not the point. You broke in.
She didn't. All she did was turn the handle. That's not... But Terry doesn't let Molly finish.
And another thing, she goes on. I was in the attic this morning. Are you actually getting anything done up there?
Vivian doesn't want to get rid of anything, Molly says. Her heartbeat is starting to quicken.
What is Terry saying? That she thinks Molly's not doing what she's supposed to be doing?
Terry puts the hand holding the dish rag on her hip.
I let Jack talk me into suggesting this to Vivian. Don't ask me why. A kid like you... Listen, if you can't finish the job...
I'm doing my best, Molly says. Terry shakes her head.
If you can't get this done, I'm the one who's going to look bad to Vivian. Do you get that? Or are you just thinking about yourself?
Molly is shocked to feel hot tears suddenly pressing behind her eyes. She doesn't cry.
She never cries. She's certainly not going to cry in front of Terry.
She looks past her,
focusing hard on a shiny blue vase sitting on a table, and wills the tears away. Any words she might say to Terry are squashed to nothing in her throat. She can tell it won't do any good to object to the unfairness. Terry's already decided that Molly is worthless, a slacker, a thief.
A kid like you.
Terry sighs.
Look, I don't mean to be hard on you. Jack likes you. Just get the attic done, all right? And no more walking in here without permission. Got it?
Molly nods, still looking hard at the vase. There are purple flowers in it, and tall sprays of something white and feathery.
I guess, now that you're here, we can see if Vivian wants to get something done upstairs,
Terry goes on.
But you'll have to wait for her to come down. I'm not going to go upstairs and hurry her, and I've got my own work to do. I suppose you can stay in here.
She heads back to the kitchen, leaving the door open behind her. Molly sinks into a chair. She looks around at the bookshelves, but she doesn't dare to pull out a book. Terry probably thinks Molly would steal any book she gets her hands on. The book Vivian gave to Molly is still in her backpack. Well, at least that's one thing that's been cleaned out of the attic. Molly pulls it out and opens it to the first page. The neat lines of letters on the page soothe her. She feels her heartbeat slow down as she settles into the book. Let somebody else's troubles fill her mind for a while. Troubles she can close the cover on and set aside when she's done. The sun moves higher in the sky and the room brightens as Molly reads about old Matthew Cuthbert going somewhere in his buggy and nosy Mrs. Lynde just dying of curiosity. Mrs. Lynde reminds her of Terry. The idea makes her smile.
Are you actually getting anything done up there?
It's something Mrs. Lynde might say, for sure. She turns the page and Matthew is at the train station meeting a girl. An orphan who needs a home. The Cuthberts don't want a girl, they want a boy. A boy to help with the farm work. But instead they get a red-haired girl who talks too much and isn't what they need. Not what they signed up for, in fact. After a little while, the door to the hall opens and Molly looks up. Vivian comes in, glances around the room, focuses on Molly, and smiles.
Bright and early, she says. Maybe I'll let you empty out a box today, or two, if you're lucky. Maybe I'll even answer some questions for that canoeing paper of yours. Now, let's have a cup of tea.
Neve, Albans, Minnesota, 1929. On a Monday morning, after she'd been at the Burns's for 5 days, Neve got up early and washed her face in the kitchen sink. She braided her hair carefully and attached 2 ribbons she'd found in the scrap pile in the sewing room. Then she put on her cleanest dress and her pinafore. At breakfast, lumpy oatmeal with no sugar, she asked the Burns how to get to school. Mrs. Byrne looked at her husband, then back at Neve.
Dorothy, Mr. Byrne and I feel that you are not ready for school.
Neve looked at Mr. Byrne, studiously tying his shoelace.
But I'm supposed to go, she said.
The timing is unfortunate, Mrs. Byrne said. School has been in session for a month. You are impossibly behind, with no chance of catching up this year. Neve's skin prickled.
But Mrs. Scatcherd said,
Mrs. Scatcherd isn't here now, is she? We're the ones who decide what's best for you, and we think you should wait. Lord knows what your schooling was like in the slum.
I wasn't in a slum, she choked out. I was in the 4th grade. My teacher was Miss Ulrig. I was in the chorus, and we did an operetta, Polished Pebbles.
They both looked at her. This was the longest speech Neve had made in their house yet.
I like school, she said.
Mrs. Byrne got up and started to stack the dishes, taking Neve's plate, even though she hadn't finished her toast.
You insolent girl! I don't want to hear another word, she said. Is that clear?
The subject of school never came up again. Mr. Byrne always left the house after breakfast, though Neve was never sure exactly what he did while he was gone. Neve would go into the sewing room once she'd finished washing the dishes. Several times a day, Mrs. Byrne would appear there, but she never picked up a needle.
She inspected what had been sewn, handed out new orders, and collected the finished garments. There were many rules in the Burns' household. Neve learned about them mostly by breaking them and being scolded